Hello, welcome to Muriel's Murders. I'm Muriel, and I love true crime.
I'm Nick, and I'm not a fan.
Thank you for joining us. Each week, I force Nick to listen to me tell him a story of a true crime. This week, we bring you part two of our two-part series on Canadian serial killer Bruce MacArthur.
We want to thank the listeners who sent us some money on Venmo while we were stuck in Mexico. You absolutely made our time there so much more fun. We got Tevin, Addie, Natalie, Courtney, Lindsay, and Paulette. Thank you so much. And both this episode and the last are dedicated to Kelsey W. Thank you so much for the happy birthday wishes and your donation. Let us experience the same things Bruce MacArthur used to do on his vacations to Puerto Vallarta. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you are feeling what Muriel and I are doing with this podcast, please check out our Patreon. The link is in the show notes of this episode. Our eighth Patreon exclusive episode is all about the crime and murder that happened on Yalapa, a town in Mexico we just returned from. All your support over there on Patreon means the world to us.
All right, this is a true story involving murder, violence, drugs, adult themes, etc. So if any listeners are like Nick and they don't want to hear about those kind of things, please just listen to a different podcast.
Plus, we'll probably end up doing a little cursing and joking, so if you're sensitive to that, turn us off.
All right, Nikki, are you ready to hear this story?
No!
Okay, let's get started. Favorite things in the world, Nick's recap of what I said last week.
Okay. In part one, we learned that Muriel chose this story because she believed Bruce MacArthur killed people in Puerto Vallarta and then didn't realize that he probably only killed people in Canada until she had invested too much time into the research to change course. He did, however, spend time in the exact same places that Muriel and I enjoyed in Puerto Vallarta. Muriel said it straight out last episode that Bruce MacArthur is indeed a serial killer, so there's no real chance that he was innocent in any of this. But the only crimes she really laid out for us were his attacks on guys who survived. The other thing that she laid out was a series of missing men that spanned from 2010 to 2017. I think the number is at five missing men where we left it off last week. All of them, as well as the two survivors, have a lot in common with their killer. They're gay men with beards, baby boomers on the verge of like Gen Xers, like that type of generation. Yeah. And they were all a part of Toronto's Village neighborhood. The first four missing men were all immigrants from countries including Sri Lanka, Afghanistan, and Turkey. And the final missing guy is a Canadian-born white dude, which is important to note because up until this point, Bruce MacArthur, like lots of serial killers, follow very strict patterns. The other important Bruce MacArthur details that are just flooding, bubbling on my cute little brain include that his first known act of violence didn't happen until he was about 50 years old, which is incredibly late in life for killers to get started. He is a known family man with seemingly good relations with his ex-wife, daughter, and son. His son Todd has been in and out of legal trouble for more than a decade because he compulsively makes obscene phone calls to women. Mm-hmm. He was living with his dad and working for his landscaping company when we left off the story last week. But the main tricky thing Muriel did, the what? Real thing she was up to over there telling that story, was she set up all those facts without actually telling us what Bruce did. So I'm readying myself for a disturbing episode ahead. I think this woman is going to explain all the violence and kidnapping and murdering and God knows what else. I mean, last episode involved online cannibal communities and snipers killing a cannibal in Slovakia, a kid's hockey coach who videotaped them in the locker room. So, you know, I'm very clenched in general for whatever she has in store for us today. And I believe where we left off the story was with police deciding that Bruce MacArthur was indeed their number one prime suspect.
Wow, Nick, I think that's the most thorough recap you've ever done. I feel like you listened to me very closely.
Well, I had to edit it. I mean, I guess I always have to edit it.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Your recaps sometimes are a little
wonky.
But that was great.
That was pretty good.
Dang.
All right, tight. Well,
yeah, you sound like a newspaper man getting to the facts.
Well, I am trying to make money at something in life. Okay, all right. Muriel, the floor is yours.
Okay, so where we left off last week, Project Prism is in full swing.
Yeah.
This is the search for Andrew Kinsman and Salim Essen, who had disappeared from the village, yeah. right? And Bruce MacArthur is finally the main subject. I do want to add that it's actually really hard to pinpoint exactly when police working on the Project Prism case knew about Bruce MacArthur's previous dealings with police,
uh-huh.
right?
Uh-huh.
So like you said, he's had three experiences with police. One of them was he was convicted of assault in mm-hmm. 2003 for a 2001 pipe attack on a man from yeah. the village, right?
Right?
It was completely unprovoked. Then in 2013, he was interviewed because he had connections to all three men in Project Houston that
right.
were missing, right?
Yes, yes.
And then again in 2016, he was accused of an attempted strangulation in the back of his van.
Right.
That was dismissed by police officers. There was no victim statement taken.
Yeah.
And no one looked into his background.
Right.
So at this point, we know in 2022 that those things happened.
Yeah.
In 2018, when this investigation, or 2017, when this investigation is going down,
mm-hmm.
we're not exactly sure when police actually started understanding the depth of how much they had missed when interviewing Bruce MacArthur in the past.
Got it.
Right?
Right.
We'll get into this a little later, but at the very least, there seem to have been some massive miscommunications among the Toronto police regarding these investigations, allegations, and interviews.
Mm-hmm.
So in the fall of 2017, while 30-something Todd MacArthur was out on bail for making nasty phone calls and crashing at his dad's house, police got busy pulling months of footage from Bruce MacArthur's apartment parking garage. And they immediately discover some crappy news. Apparently, a few weeks after Project Prism was announced,
yeah.
Bruce started driving a completely different minivan.
Uh-huh.
He had ditched the red Dodge Caravan, mm-hmm. the location of at least one known assault and the last known place Andrew Kinsman was seen.
Right, because they had the video footage of him getting into the car.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So police do some digging and they find out where Bruce bought this minivan from. They contact the dealership, and the dealership is a little cagey. They don't want to talk, but they say this. They mm-hmm. say Bruce called. He bought the van over the phone, sight unseen. He said he didn't care about the color and he just wanted the cheapest minivan they had.
Okay. Right? Anything that's not my red minivan. Exactly. Do you guys have anything in stock that's not my murdery
my
red?
My murder van.
My right. murder van.
So that's all interesting, right?
Uh-huh.
But the bigger question is, where the F is the old van? It's a big deal.
Uh-huh.
So obviously, in this active investigation, none of this was released to the public at the time. And who knows what police knew about all their prior interactions with Bruce MacArthur. But in the fall of 2017, police had enough circumstantial evidence to get hella warrants to go through Bruce MacArthur's stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Police searched all of MacArthur's known associated properties mm-hmm. and found the van parked outside his daughter's house in Bowmanville, Ontario. So that's maybe an hour and a half outside of Toronto.
So they found it immediately.
Immediately, but also like, yeah. you know, at his daughter's house, is like, he's like, hey, I don't want this van anymore. Just keep it.
Right.
There was like a little bit of energy kind of speckled into a lot of these articles that I've read about
uh-huh.
how police kind of hinted at family might have covered up some things for Bruce MacArthur.
Oh, interesting.
So it's not anything that anyone has been accused of or is on uh-huh. trial for, but there's like a little like scuttlebutty kind of
some slight shade
like
being
some
thrown.
Shade being thrown.
Okay.
Right? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So police now move some of the surveillance to keep an eye on the red Dodge Caravan. They put a GPS tracking device on Bruce's new vehicle. They followed him and then got a discarded coffee cup that he had thrown away,
mm-hmm.
got some DNA from that. They watched him work landscaping gigs with Todd, his son, while they were still developing these gorgeous gardens mm-hmm. sort of working out of Karen Frazier's
So this garage. Is a straight up spy mission.
They're fully watching him, you know, by the fall of 2017. 17. They're everywhere that he goes. They know where he goes. They map his patterns.
Wow. All kinds of stuff. Yeah. Well, you were saying too, he's terrible at taking jokes or even recognizing that a joke is happening. I could just see him being clearly spied on and him not recognizing
it. I know. Cause he goes so many places. It's not like, you know, yeah. for us, if somebody was spied on us outside our apartment, it'd be a long time before I was like, that van's been there a while.
Yeah.
But it's like, if you're feeling watched everywhere you go.
Yeah.
That I feel like you'd kind of like start to understand that, but I don't know.
Yeah.
They probably have tactics.
They're probably great spies. They're probably spying on us right now. Okay.
Okay. So on September 27th, 2017, detectives checked on the Reg Dodge Caravan in Bowmanville and Heart Attack City found out it was missing. So that kicks off a desperate search for the van. On October 3rd, about a week later, police find the van at Dom's Auto Parts in Cordis, Ontario, about a 10-minute drive east of Bowmanville.
Uh-huh.
And the van had been purchased on September 16th, with the owner of Dom's being able to provide actual surveillance footage from that day of one of Bruce's known relatives selling the van.
Mm-hmm.
They sold the van for scrap for $125. And the owner of Dom's, Dominic Vitieri, said the only thing he found weird about the interaction was that the relative didn't negotiate at all. They just seemed focused only on getting the van scrapped and then subsequently sent to the wrecking yard.
Yeah, I mean, 125 seems like nothing unless the car's like not running at all.
Well, I think it was running. Right. It was driving.
That's super shady.
Right. And also, it turns out Bruce has a long history of wrecking his vehicles, which I just think is kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. That when he gets rid of them, he scraps them and wrecks them. He's like, So police go searching and they find a red Dodge Caravan. It's been stripped. The license plate is gone and some of the stuff on the outside, like the chrome, is gone. But the interior was still intact and they were able to identify it by the VIN number.
Uh-huh.
So they're like, great, this is awesome. They tow it back to Toronto for analysis. On November 8th, police found small traces of blood and bodily fluids in the van from three different DNA profiles.
Mm-hmm.
The blood, which was about the size of the tip of a pencil, it matched Andrew Kinsman.
Oof.
And they found DNA from Salim Essen, the second victim of Project Prism.
Right.
The DNA matches were enough to get an expanded warrant, and police were able to legally enter MacArthur's apartment on December 5th while he was out running errands. But all these police came into this apartment, and then all of a sudden they get the call. For some reason, Bruce MacArthur is abruptly coming back home. Mm-hmm. So they had to, you know, 11th hour scatter out of this apartment and not be seen.
Okay.
I think they had something like 10 minutes to go. Yeah. So police go back to search again on the 7th. And this time they split into two teams to cover their rooms more quickly. One team copied Bruce MacArthur's computer hard drive, and then the other searched his bedroom trying to find evidence. They found a thick metal bar by his bed. They took a DNA swab of the bar. They took some photographs, and they cloned half his hard drive before getting word again that MacArthur was returning home earlier than expected.
Mm-hmm.
But they did get a little more evidence this time. On December 8th, 2017... police made a public statement to wrap up the year, assuring the public that there was still no evidence of a serial killer in the village and that they had found no evidence linking Project Prism and Project Houston.
So did they believe that, or were they saying that just to chill everyone out?
As far as I've read,
yeah.
Some of that stuff's a little hanky.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's hard to tell. They're obviously not wanting to tip off that they have a suspect.
Sure.
You know, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
This is all my speculation.
Yeah.
So I could see that, but I think genuinely they still were thinking that Bruce MacArthur was maybe connected to disappearances but hadn't actually been a killer. Like, they don't have the evidence to support that there was a murder, right?
Sure.
They just have evidence to support that there's connections, right?
Yeah.
Although, remember, if you take into account the scope of all of his interactions with police, then you might think, oh, yeah, this guy might have something to do with Project Houston.
So, yeah, right.
You know what I mean? It's a little bit like, okay. So on January 17th, police made another pass at their clone of that half of Bruce MacArthur's hard drive, and they found a previous deleted folder full of photos. There were photos of Salim Essen with the metal bar against his neck.
Oh.
And photos of Andrew Kinsman in the Dodge Caravan.
Yeah.
Surrounded by potted plants. And it was clear that both men were dead in the photographs.
Oh, my God. He took photos of them?
They also found photos of other men that they just straight up couldn't identify.
Yeah.
Photos of men tied to MacArthur's bed, dressed up in that fur coat that he liked, posed with cigars. Some were in the Dodge Caravan, some were in his apartment.
Dead guys? All dead?
There were all kinds of photos. Okay. Right? Like pictures of people. And we'll get more into the photographs later, there was lots of posing, cigars, fur hats.
But you use that term posing for like when after a killer has killed someone, they do something with the body.
Right.
So do you mean it in that way here? Or do you just mean like people posing with cigars?
No, the bodies were posed by Bruce MacArthur. They were staged.
Yeah.
So the assumption was the men were either incapacitated deceased.
Got it.
So it was a little hard to tell which one, but later we'll find out that he experimented with people with GHB, which is the date rape drug, the one that kind of incapacitates you.
Yeah.
So it was hard to tell in the photographs. I think there was like a wide spectrum.
That makes sense.
But at the very least, they were obviously posed by Bruce MacArthur.
So it sounds like this guy's body count might start to skyrocket here.
Right. I mean, we don't know. But surprise, Bruce MacArthur's a serial killer. And Toronto police made plans to arrest him on January 20th, ramping up 24-hour surveillance with plans to arrest him and intervene if he tried to engage with anyone privately.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the next day, things changed. On January 18th, 2018, police surveilling MacArthur saw him pick up a man who fit the Project Houston victim's profile, right? And then take the man back to his apartment. So we're talking about someone from Middle Eastern or South Asian descent, someone with a beard.
Mm-hmm.
The man, we're going to call him Brad, he had actually dated MacArthur before. They met on the Growler app. Because Brad wasn't married to a woman and still in the closet, he always appreciated MacArthur's commitment to discretion.
Mm-hmm.
But this particular morning, Bruce was acting really over the top, according to Brad. Bruce was driving a different car. He seemed super stressed and rushed. And he repeatedly grilled Brad, trying to make sure absolutely no one knew where he was or who he was with. It seemed in character for Bruce, just a little more aggressive than usual. So Brad didn't see any red flags right away.
Yeah.
Right? So they get into the parking garage and they go up to the 19th floor inside Bruce's apartment. And Bruce explains, you know, sorry, I'm flustered because I'm worried, you know, either his son or his roommate would come home any minute.
Yeah.
So he says, we just have to kind of be quick about this. And then he tells Brad they were going to do something different this time. So before Brad could really clock what was going on, Bruce handcuffed him to the bed, then put a leather hood with no holes over his head. So at this point, Brad starts to panic, and he manages to knock the hood off. But when he does, he sees MacArthur is right there in front of him with a roll of duct tape ready to tape his mouth shut.
Where are, do the cops kick in the door?
That's when there was a knock on the door.
Nah, kick it in, man.
As soon as police witnessed Bruce leading Brad up to his apartment,
surveillance
teams broke with their plans, rushing to the building to arrest Bruce MacArthur 2 days early in this emergency rescue mission. But because of that, they didn't have anyone in place to arrest MacArthur that day.
Yeah.
So the arresting officers had to take the main elevator of the apartment building all the way up to Bruce MacArthur's apartment on the 19th floor. And this is a floor so high, from his windows, you can see the street where Project Houston victim Basir Fazi's car was found.
Yeah.
And you can see all like the green ravines and the gardens of the houses where Bruce worked, like from his window.
Yeah, yeah. So what you're saying is it took a long ass time for the cops to actually get up there.
Basically, the elevator crawled up and stopped at like every third floor with all these guys who were just like trying to be like, you can't use the elevator right now, right?
Yeah.
So detectives knock on Bruce MacArthur's door, and when he opened it, they immediately handcuffed him and ran to the back bedroom where they found Brad handcuffed to the bed, terrified, but unharmed.
Oh, yeah. Unharmed. That's so great.
So Bruce was then arrested for the murders of Andrew Kinsman and Salim Essen.
Mm.
So just the two men from Project Prism.
Yeah.
While looking through the apartment, the police didn't find any substantial physical evidence, like no bodies, blood, or hair in the apartment. Mm-hmm. But they did find some belongings from a couple of the missing men from Project Houston, some jewelry and a notebook.
So that's pretty crazy evidence. Yeah, that's a lot.
I mean, obviously, now we're starting to see there's a collection of photographs, a collection of mementos. You know, you're starting to kind of click together what type of person this guy is.
Yeah.
He likes holding on to things. That afternoon at 1:15 p.m., Sergeant Detective Hank Itzinga announced the murder charges against Bruce for the deaths of Andrew Kinsman and Salim Essen. And I'm assuming based on the photographs, he also added, quote, "We believe he is responsible for the deaths of Mr. Essen and Mr. Kinsman, and we believe he is responsible for the deaths of other men who have yet to be identified. In other words, we believe there are other victims."
Yeah.
And when investigators interviewed Bruce, he denied everything. So Bruce was never a source of information at all throughout the course of this. I just want to acknowledge that, but never.
Okay.
So we're not going to hear anything.
He never cops to it.
Right. So we're going to go back to Karen Fraser's house. Karen Fraser's house is on Mallory Crescent, this beautiful cul-de-sac.
Mm-hmm.
And on this beautiful cul-de-sac, it stands out particularly for having lush greenery surrounding her home, right?
Yeah.
In the spring and summer, the front of the property is sheltered by these big leafy trees. And then behind the home is this gorgeous garden. It's filled with these massive planters. There are 15 in total, flower beds. And just beyond that is a ravine that slopes down into the Don Valley and the east end of Toronto. So it's a really beautiful place.
I think I might have sort of interrupted you when you brought her up just a few minutes ago. So just so the listeners all remember and are caught up, she's like the family friend of the MacArthurs, who's sort of a rich lady who allows Bruce to run his business out of her garage.
Yes.
And in exchange for some free landscaping. And then he also like gives flowers to the charities she helps run money for.
Right. And it's really, her home is really impressive.
Like
the landscaping is kind of a, you know, a shining star.
Has this guy been burying bodies in all of his clients' yards?
On January 21st, police swarmed Karen Fraser's front yard. Karen heard a knock at the door, and when she opened it, police emerged from the recesses of her yard, telling her she had 5 minutes to vacate the property.
Whoa.
So Karen demanded badge numbers and a warrant, but found out quickly that their request was legit. And she and her husband, Ron, had 5 minutes to pack what they needed before they were expelled from their house for an undefined amount of time.
Damn.
All they were told was that their gardener had been arrested and they were to report immediately to a police station in Toronto. So down at the station, they were split up. They were separated. And Ron was interrogated first. So while that was happening, Karen was waiting for her turn, scrolling on her phone. And she reads the headline, "Toronto police charge 66-year-old Bruce MacArthur with first-degree murder in connection to the disappearances of Salim Essen and Andrew Kinsman."
Yeah.
So at this point, Karen didn't know it was like tax evasion, you know, or like whatever. Like she literally didn't know anything about it.
Right, right.
So this is what she sees.
Yeah.
So obviously she freaks. And the first thing she said that came to her mind was Bruce's mismanaged diabetes. So when Karen's turn for interrogation starts, she goes in and she tells police immediately, you know, Bruce was just diagnosed and he wasn't taking it seriously.
Uh-huh.
And that her father kind of did the same thing with his diabetes. Like he didn't manage it and then he would become violent when his blood sugar was spiking or dropping. But even as the words left her mouth, she was like, OMG, what am I talking about? father didn't murder two people.
Yeah, right. And she's just like rushing to make sense of all of this chaos that has suddenly flooded her life and is like, this person that I know and trust and support and love is a murderer. Like, you're gonna snap to some crazy justifications.
Well, and that's like what most people who knew Bruce MacArthur were going through at the
moment, sure,
right?
Sure.
Because unlike some other, you know, like a recluse or someone who you thought was kind of shady or you always thought it was that guy, you know, he's cultivated this image of safety and, you know, reliability and
well, he's the Santa nature. Claus at the local mall every Christmas season.
Right. On January 21st, 2018,
Which is a detail. You can't even write that. Like, the serial killer is the Santa Claus?
It's too much. So January 21st, 2018, police searched every inch of Karen Fraser's house. And then they moved on to the frozen backyard. Mm-hmm. Investigators set up a tent on the property to inspect the lawn with ground penetrating radar, using these massive heaters to thaw the ground.
And I'm so sorry. Isn't this happening in the summer?
January 1st, 2018.
Okay.
I literally just said it.
Sorry.
And it's Canada. So
it's hella months later after they arrested him.
I have been telling you every date up until this point. And we started it in the fall. Are you kidding me?
I thought he got arrested in like July. And it's all this time later. They're just getting to the...
This is so important that you're not understanding.
Okay. I'm sorry.
He was never arrested in July. They didn't even have enough evidence to do anything but survey him in September. We started this story in September.
Oh, okay.
And then we did October, and then we did November, and then we did December.
Right.
Now we're in January 2018.
Okay.
It's the winter time.
Okay.
That's why her planters are frozen. God damn it. This is really important because, like, that's what we're saying is that there's all this information coming out to the public, and there's a lot of suspicion going on with the public, but that all went through the summer and the fall and the winter.
Yeah.
And the last major, you know, on December 8th, the police announced that there was no serial killer and no connection between Andrew.
Right,
I mean, that's like a big deal.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so we're back on the scene. They're thawing this yard. It's a crazy ass archaeological exercise.
Don't try to save yourself. All right. So January 21st, 2018, police searched every inch of Karen Fraser's house, and then they moved to the frozen backyard. So investigators sent up a tent on the property, so big tent, to inspect the lawn with ground penetrating radar. Mm-hmm. And they also used big heaters to thaw the ground because it's Canada, so it's freezing, and then digging up, like using a backhoe to dig up the backyard.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, police search Bruce MacArthur's apartment and vehicles. In his apartment, they found 10 USB drives. So
that's a lot.
That's a lot of USB drives. A duffel bag full of syringes, zip ties, bungee cords, duct tape, and some surgical gloves.
Oh, my God.
And in his new van, police found a hidden compartment under the floorboards where Bruce had stashed the fur coat featured in most of his killings.
Mm.
So he made sure he had it on him. And the picture of that is just really unnerving. It's basically just they pull up, you know, like the carpet that's on a van, and it's just the metal flooring.
Yeah.
And then they found a little tiny cutout thing and pulled it up, and then stuffed inside is this coat. So it's just like a bubble of fur coming out of these black...
Which can only be imagined as the world's most disgusting fur coat at this point.
On January 29th, Detective Sergeant Hank Itzinga once again took the podium to hold another press conference, and he dropped a solid bombshell. Quote, Mr. MacArthur has now been charged with 3 additional counts of first-degree murder. These new charges are in relation to the murders of Majid Kahan, Sarush Mahmoudi, and Dean Lisowick. So Majid Kahan, who went by Hamid, was one of the men who disappeared and was investigated by Project Houston.
Yeah, we talked about him a fair amount last episode.
Right. So Sergeant Itzinga continued by saying, Sarush Mahmoudi was 50 years old when he was reported missing in Scarborough by his family in 2015. Dean Lisowick was never reported as missing, but we believe he was murdered between May of 2016 and July of 2017. So Bruce MacArthur was being charged with 3 murders, but only one of them was for a man connected to Project Houston.
Mm-hmm.
The assumption was he'd be charged for the men from Project Houston and the men from Project Prism, totaling 5 murders.
Right.
Now police were charging with the murders of men whose disappearances hadn't even entered into the conversation.
So we're up to 7.
Right. So we thought there were 5 victims. Now there are probably 7 and most likely more than that.
And right now we have no recovering of any bodies or anything.
None.
Yeah.
So all of the flowers, remember, because it's wintertime, Nikki. All of the flowers and grass were dead or winter dormant in the Fraser yard, and the only distinguishable feature was these large snow-covered planters that filled the space until spring. Mm-hmm. The planters, Karen said, Bruce would always eat his lunch around and sometimes arranging them so they surrounded him. On January 29th, police announced that dismembered remains had been found at the bottom of Karen Fraser's planters. And they finally called MacArthur a serial killer for the first time.
Man, I feel like you would smell the rotting body parts and everything in there. But maybe he was just like, oh, that's the fertilizer I'm using. Wouldn't you just smell it? That's weird, too, that he sat around and landscaped his dead bodies around him and would just enjoy his lunches with the sun out there.
You might think that like he's just a complete psychopath.
Yeah, but I mean, I just feel like, what? Like, did you, is that, I mean, I know that you didn't make it up, but it's like, and he's Santa Claus? Oh, all right. So
we're going to go to Sarush Mahmoodi. Mm-hmm. So he's one of the previously unknown victims, and he disappeared overnight in August 2015 at the age of 50. Mm-hmm. His family assumed he'd vanished on his way to work. Sarush immigrated to Canada from Iran, and when he got to Canada, he married a Sri Lankan woman named Farina and took over the role of stepfather to Farina's son. So he was known as a really great father, a great husband, and a great cook.
Yeah.
Author Justin Ling points out that Sarush Mahmoodi's case is a good example as to how little police work was done in some of these missing person cases prior to Project Prism. Mm-hmm. So since 2015, Sarush's disappearance remained unsolved. I believe he was another person police claimed had quote unquote vacated his life. You know, they had talked about someone voluntarily sort of running away or leaving, right?
Right.
But Sarush had a police record that no one had looked into. So he had an issue with alcoholism. He had a lot of DUIs and then things related to that. Mm-hmm. But there was one charge for assault that tells a broader story of Sarush's life in Toronto. 15 years prior to his disappearance, Sarush was actually living in the Toronto Village with his girlfriend of 3 years, a trans woman named Sarah. So Sarah was trying to break things off with Sarush after he had suddenly started displaying abusive behavior. Mm-hmm. And when Sarah packed her bags and tried to leave, Sarush snapped and he attacked her with a heavy glass pitcher. So she survived, but it was a really terrible assault. He was charged with domestic assault and he pled guilty in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And if police had just simply looked into his arrest record, they would have found that beyond his ethnicity and appearance, he fit the profile of the missing Houston men much more closely than it appeared at first glance. He had spent several years living and working in the village,
right?
You know, and had gone to those bars and had a life there before getting married to Farina. So it was kind of a big thing to miss,
right?
The other previously unknown victim was Dean Lisowick. So Dean was just dealt a really crappy hand. When he was young, Dean's parents were too poor to support him, so they voluntarily sent him into foster care at the age of 8, where he was sexually abused. And he remained in foster care until he aged out of the system and then returned to Toronto as an adult.
Yeah.
So pretty soon after that, Dean fell into drugs, like in the mid-90s. So he fathered a child and kind of floated around, and he eventually landed in the village where he fully came out and started to put down his roots in the community. Mm-hmm. So Dean got into sex work to support himself, but it was right at this time in Toronto where there was a big push to crack down on sex work. That was like in the late 90s, early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And that led a lot of people, including Dean, to lose their jobs.
Yeah.
He eventually lost his housing because of this, and then he struggled on and off with drug addiction. But really, you know, from what I've read, he was known around the village, even though he's panhandling and he was essentially like just living out of missions. Mm-hmm. He was just known as being this really sweet, kind guy, kind of like a fixture in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
He wasn't in contact with his daughter or most of his family, but he always sent his mother birthday cards on her birthday. Mm-hmm. So Dean disappeared sometime between 2016 and 2017, around the age of 47. And while he had some friends in the village and he was known by his shelter workers at the Scott Mission, and he was still in contact with a cousin, just no one reported him missing.
Yeah.
So he was never even looked at until this investigation. By February, police had set up a command center at the Fraser home. On February 8th,
they just took over those people's houses.
They gave it back like right around, you know, like around this time, but they just definitely just like commandeered the house for like 3 weeks or something.
Yeah.
On February 8th, they announced that they had recovered the remains of at least six people in the 15 planters on the property in various stages of decomposition.
Oh my God.
And the cause of death for most of the victims that they found was strangulation.
Uh-huh.
They only identified Andrew Kinsman to start. That was the only set of remains.
So they yeah.
Yeah, that was the only set of remains that they could actually identify at the beginning.
Uh-huh. Well, because he was the freshest, to put a, the use, most a use a crude term.
Yeah. Right. So on February 23rd, police charged Bruce MacArthur with Skanda Navaratnam's murder. Mm-hmm. So you remember him from episode one.
R.I.P. Yeah.
Right. So that brought the total murder charges at this point up to six.
Oof.
That same week, Mark Saunders, the chief of the Toronto Police Service, came to the Daily Globe and Mail newspaper offices for a meeting. When asked whether the fact that a serial killer could be that active for that long in the village was a significant failure on the behalf of police,
mm-hmm.
Mark Saunders answered no. Saunders said, quote, "Listen, we knew something was up, which is why we went in to begin with. We did not have the evidence, and working it back again in hindsight, it's very clear that he was able to navigate in the community. Bruce MacArthur had friends, family, loved ones. He would be in bars. He was Santa Claus and all of these things. And all the while, nobody knew. If anyone would know before us, it's people that knew him very, very well."
So he's basically blaming Bruce's family for not realizing he's a serial killer.
So like there's like little things like that in police quotes that come up. Yeah. And so this is the rest of the quote.
Okay.
And so that did not come out. And I'm not going to point fingers because we're past that with the loss of life. It is catastrophic here. But he continued by asking, "What can we do better? We knew that people were missing and we knew that we didn't have the right answers, but nobody was coming to us with anything." Mm-hmm. Nobody. So that's his big, like, out of the gate. He's a serial killer. We're finding remains.
Right.
Right? It's like...
It's all of your guys' fault for not telling us about it quicker.
A little bit, right? Yeah. So, like, that's kind of... So that's the reaction from the community. So basically, because the relationship between the Toronto LGBTQ plus community and the police was already in shambles, right? Mm-hmm. There was all this stuff going on. There was those mass arrests happening.
Right, at the park.
At the park that weren't even resolved until the fall of 2017. Yeah, so like, while Bruce MacArthur is still out there, you know, they're still, you know, in courts trying to get these charges dropped.
Right.
And this statement from Mark Saunders just pushed a lot of people from the community over the edge.
Mm-hmm.
The community was expecting an apology, and instead they felt like they were being blamed for Bruce MacArthur's crimes.
Right.
You know, the Mark Saunders side of the story is that he was misquoted, but then the Globe and Mail just released the entire statement in its entirety to the public to be like, that's what he said. We didn't misquote him. But there is some kind of, you know, back and forth about what was intended.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Community activist Mita Hans, who knew some of the victims and is a big figure in the Toronto village, summed up the community's feelings about Mark Saunders' statement to the Globe. She told Justin Ling, quote, "How much more do you expect from us? Do you expect this from other communities to do your work for you? And how dare you further victimize the people that are already not getting the good end of this deal, the societal deal we have, where we pay your salaries to do your job and then you don't do it. And when you do it, you do it completely wrong and your focus is completely wrong. There's so much to be angry at."
Mm.
So I use that quote because from the community and, and the things that I've been reading, that sums up
the point of view.
The point of view.
Basically. Totally. Yeah.
After Bruce MacArthur's arrest, there was a huge rush amongst journalists to go over his Facebook page and dating profiles before they were deactivated to try to figure out
what this dude was about, right?
Oh man, that's such a weird modern issue,
right?
It's like, oh shit, you better get on his. Just it's. What about the MySpace? Is his MySpace still up?
I looked through. I tried to find him, and I couldn't find anything. And then I read this book, and I was like, oh, they deactivated it in 2018. So his Facebook was super active. There were photos of him and his family, Bruce as the mall Santa, photos of him at Pride that year in 2017, little blurbs about his recent visits to Rome and then Puerto Vallarta the year prior. And he was Facebook friends with Skanda's long inactive Facebook account, along with piles of South Asian and Middle Eastern men with beards. So basically everyone who fit the profile of the missing men from Project Houston.
Yeah.
And to a certain extent, also Andrew Kinsman, right? The beard, kind of like the same type. The body type, right? Yeah. That was all the wall of his Facebook friends. That was everybody.
Yeah.
On dating profiles, which were still up at the time, he went by Silver Fox, Silver Fox Toronto, or the classic Silver Fox 51. And he was on all the apps. He was on Silver Daddy.
Yeah.
These, some of these are just fantastic names. I know I'm not trying to make light, but it's like Silver Daddies, Man Jam, Grinder, Bear 411, Bear Forest, Scruff, Daddy Hunt, Squirt, and Growler. So he's on all of the major apps.
Yeah, yeah, he had his bases covered.
Right. And from app to app, he described himself a little differently. So sometimes he'd say, quote, average guy looking to make friends. I am self-employed with my own landscaping business, so that keeps me busy most of the time. I can be a bit shy until I get to know you, but I'm a romantic at heart. So that's out there.
Okay.
Another read, you know, he's looking for guys with a, quote, kinky side.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, other apps would read something like, quote, like to give abuse to submissive men of all ages. Like to find a guy's buttons and push till you can't take anymore. Like to push a guy's limits till they go over the edge into long sessions to see how much you can take. So it definitely escalates depending on the app that he's
Which makes a fair amount of sense. I mean, to me, that's not like some, you know, indication of like crazy split personality or something.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Like, yeah, if you want, you know, I like this over here and I recognize that this app attracts this type of, you know, person. So I'm going to do this. And that's true for me. And then this other thing is also true for me.
Yeah, right. So I guess it's not like escalating. It's just kind of different apps. But it definitely, you know, you give the people what they want on whatever app. Like, he's not, I mean, to say, like, on one app, like, I'm shy and romantic. Yeah. I mean, they are very.
Right.
He's representing himself in a pretty different light, you know?
Yeah, right.
But
I don't know. This is coming from two people who literally have never had a dating profile on any app.
I know. One of the dating profiles featured photos Andrew Kinsman had taken of Bruce in a leather jacket leaning against a tree. So he was like, oh, yeah, I'll help you out with your dating profile. Let me take a picture. Because they had been friends for years.
Oh. I know. And then his other victims like worked for him and he's
just
like
friends for years too.
He's like killing his friends.
So in March of 2018, after the bodies had been found in the planters or some of the bodies, the Canadian press, the Toronto press kind of had this crazy explosive moment. So they discovered two newspapers discovered the previous 2013 and 2016 interviews police had conducted with Bruce MacArthur and brought them to light. So at this point, the public had no idea. Right? Justin Ling, our author from our source material, and Tu Tan Ha had been working on a story for the Globe and Mail with an insider police informant about Project Houston starting as a search for a cannibal and leading to an interview with Bruce MacArthur in the fall of 2013.
Yeah. Right?
So this informant told Ling and Ha the whole thing that we know at this time, that Bruce admitted to knowing two out of the three missing men, Skanda and Hamid, but not Bazir, although he had interacted with Bazir on silverdaddies.com. But despite multiple requests, police wouldn't corroborate any of the story. So they kept going back to police and saying, we have this informant, we have this information, is it true? Can you confirm or deny? They refused to even participate. And the informant said, I cannot be named, I'll lose everything. And so the story was shelved. They had been working on it for a while, right?
Yeah.
And then the story was shelved. So they said, we can't publish this because we can't confirm anything, right?
Yeah.
But on March 6th, 2018, a competing paper, the Toronto Star, dropped an article titled, quote, Bruce MacArthur was previously questioned, released by police in a separate incident. So thinking the Star had scooped their story.
Yeah.
The Globe and Mail published their story in the early morning hours on May 7th. But turns out the Star story was about a completely different secret to the public thing, right? The Star was reporting on the 2016 John Doe attack. Right? The attempted strangulation.
Yeah, yeah. So this informant's like giving different bits of information to all these different press contacts.
Actually, it, yeah, there's a lot of conspiracy around this. And this book, Missing in the Village, yeah, is so great because you really get this behind the scenes look at how journalists are covering the story in real time.
Well, from a journalist who was like, who had skin in the game and was really like kind of going for it. And didn't he write that article for Vice magazine connecting all these people? So in a lot of ways, the police chief's criticism of people not bringing anything to light is actually unfounded, because although Ling didn't name MacArthur in that Vice article, he did say all these things are connected.
I mean, that's what we're talking about here. Yeah. I mean, Mark Saunders was way, he did, you know, like there's a lot of stuff going on here, right?
Yeah.
But anyway, the Star was reporting on something completely different, but still related to the case. Yeah. So now we've got, all of a sudden, in the span of 2 days, the public knows about the 2013 interview that connected him to all of the Project Houston men. Mm-hmm. They know the 2016 arrest for attempted strangulation in the van, which the public does know was like a part of the killings.
Yeah.
And they also found the 2001 pipe attack. Because remember, when in about 2014, Bruce MacArthur got his record expunged.
Right.
So that's still available in police databases. They can still find that conviction, but I believe it's not publicly available anymore once it was expunged. So they were able to kind of illuminate all three of those things at the same time.
Yeah. Which I'm interpreting to mean a great day for newspaper sales and a pretty bad day for police at the station.
Right, because just after Police Chief Saunders told the Globe and Mail, quote, "I'm not going to point fingers because we're past that."
Yeah.
Quote, "What can we do better?"
Yeah.
Quote, "We knew the people were missing and we knew that we didn't have the right answers, but no one was coming to us with anything." Yeah. Nobody. The public found that Bruce MacArthur was questioned, not once, but twice by police. Plus he had a previous conviction for violent assault. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So all these revelations coming out in the spring of 2018 shook something loose in Toronto, and more people were reaching out to the press to tell their stories.
Mm-hmm.
In March 2018, a man named Sean Cribben told the Globe and Mail about his close call with MacArthur. So he said he chatted with MacArthur on dating apps and met him in the summer of 2017, so basically right after Andrew Kinsman's disappearance.
Mm-hmm.
He said he got into the red Dodge Caravan and they talked a little bit about this village serial killer, and then they went back to MacArthur's place and set up some ground rules for their BDSM session. So Sean was going to take some GHB, so that's just voluntarily, that's what he liked to do. But he knew exactly how much he wanted, right? Yeah. He wanted this non-incapacitating dose, like a twilight kind of dose.
Mm-hmm.
And they both agreed on, you know, the ground rules for the session and then how much GHB he was going to take. So Bruce MacArthur takes over from there. He mixes the GHB drink for Sean. And then after taking the drug, Sean knew immediately that it was too much.
Yeah.
And he was extremely compromised.
Yeah.
So Sean says MacArthur behaved really violently. He was abusive to Sean and cut off his air supply by shoving things in his mouth and sitting on his chest.
Oh my God.
And he's in and out of consciousness at this point. And in the middle of a session, MacArthur's roommate came home unexpectedly. And Sean said he heard the roommate knocking around and thinks he just got a shot of adrenaline. And he was able to clock the noise in the next room, jump up, grab his clothes, and leave.
Yeah.
And he was so incapacitated, he has no memory of getting home.
Wow.
When Bruce was arrested in January 18th, 2018, Sean was initially just relieved that he was, right? He was relieved that Andrew Kinsman's killer was finally caught, relieved that that person was off the streets.
Yeah.
Then right after his arrest, he got a call from police essentially checking to see if Sean was still alive.
Yeah.
Because Sean was featured in some of the photographs that Bruce had on these hard drives, yeah. right? Of that encounter. They were on his computer. And while Sean had been unconscious, he had been bound up in what police told him was a kill position, essentially.
That is so scary.
Right. So he was like, I really was right at the end. And I'm one of the people that were photographed.
Yeah.
On April 11th, 2018, Bruce MacArthur was charged with the murder of Abdul Bazir, or Bazir Faizi. Abdul Bazir went by the nickname Bazir, so that's what we're going to call him. So Bazir Faizi was the second man to go missing in the Project Houston timeline. So police, if you remember, they found his car in a residential street. Mm-hmm. And after they found the car, they suspended their search, claiming that Bazir had, quote unquote, vacated his life voluntarily.
Right.
Now, back in 2015, author Justin Ling went back to where Bazir disappeared. And so if you think about this, mm-hmm. he'd been working on this case at this point for, you know, 3 or 4 years.
Right.
And he stood by the where the car was found and asking the question again, why would Bazir come here, right? The only thing Ling could think of was that a quiet place like this residential street seemed like the type of place a closeted man might go for a discreet hookup. Because at this point, mm-hmm. no one knew that Bazir had any connections to the village. Mm-hmm. So Ling saw next to the cemetery that was where near where the car was parked that there was a trailhead called the Beltline Trail. So he pulled up a website that catalogs cruising sites for gay and often closeted men. Mm-hmm. And he plugged in a random address from the place where Bazir's car was found. And the closest cruising site was right there. It was the Beltline Trail. Mm-hmm. But when Bazir disappeared, it was in the middle of winter in Toronto, right? So,
right, probably some outside rendezvous are not quite on the docket.
Right, and he was just 10 minutes from indoor hookup places in the village. He was mm-hmm. just right outside the village. So, you know, he's asking himself, would Bazir really have visited the spot during the Christmas season? And he saw a review on the Beltline Trail on this app. It said, quote, it's worth the visit even in the winter. Mm-hmm. And Ling, you know, decides he's just going to walk the Beltline Trail and just get a feeling for what, you know, what it is and what can you see and what is it near. Sure. And as he's walking the Beltline Trail, he realizes he can basically see Mallory Crescent. He can almost see like the homes mm-hmm. that Bruce MacArthur was working on.
Right.
Right. That's how geographically close they are to the Beltline Trail.
Yeah.
And Ling makes the point that Bazir's case also just sticks out, right, in this whole investigation. Mm-hmm. All the men in Project Houston disappeared without any obvious evidence or clues left out behind, but police found Bazir's car in a weird place on a residential street 10 minutes from the village and in the opposite direction of his house.
Yeah.
And at the time, police concluded there was no foul play, that, you know, Bazir had been extremely unhappy since declaring bankruptcy earlier in the year, and he was really vocal about it to his family. Yeah. So they said Bazir had most likely voluntarily vacated his life. There's enough reasoning for that, right? Mm-hmm. But it was weird. Why would Bazir ditch his car in a spot so far away from public transportation if he was running away? Why wouldn't he take his passport? Why wouldn't he take any extra cash? Like, he just didn't take anything with him, right? Yeah. Now, granted, no one knew to check the village for information. Bazir's family did not know about his sexual preferences, that he would drive to the Toronto village after work often, you know, fighting rush hour traffic mm-hmm. from the suburbs. They didn't know Bazir was a regular at Zippers and the Black Eagle, mm-hmm. this like, you know, discreet and friendly leather bar, or that his last known sighting was actually with friends in the village at the village bathhouse Steamworks, which mm-hmm. was like a popular place for hookups. So after some digging, Ling finds out, you know, Bazir had friends in the village, and he often spoke about how he wanted to come out to his wife after his daughters were grown. Mm-hmm. He would also go to Salam Canada, which is it was a support group for LGBTQ Muslims. Mm-hmm. And then on the night that he disappeared, right before New Year's in 2010, he went to the Black Eagle and hung out at the Black Eagle, where like a lot of the victims used to hang out mm-hmm. and Bruce MacArthur used to hang out. Then he went to Steamworks. He saw a couple of friends at Steamworks, and then 42-year-old Bazir was never heard from again.
So he sticks out actually a lot less
after that sort of realization, he starts to fit the profile of the other two.
Right.
Yeah.
So on April 16th, law enforcement identified a man named Krishna Kumar Kanagaratnam among the remains, bringing the victim count to 8. So Krishna Kumar Kanagaratnam arrived in Canada on a cargo ship after about 100 days at sea with almost 491 fellow Sri Lankans fleeing the civil war.
Whoa.
So the huge rusty cargo ship tried to dock first in Australia, and then it was spotted near Guatemala, and it finally landed in a port in Vancouver on the 4th of July in 2010, gushing water and leaning to one side,
on its
last legs.
Wow.
And we're talking like over 3 months at sea.
That's unfathomable.
So Kanagaratnam was seeking asylum in Canada after his younger brother was murdered in the family's front yard in Sri Lanka during the war. His claim was denied twice, and he was ultimately denied refugee status and assigned to be deported.
Really?
Kanagaratnam felt like going back to Sri Lanka was just not an option, so he transitioned to living underground in Canada. He eventually made his way to Toronto and just worked random jobs to basically survive. In August 2015, he stopped contacting his friends and family, who assumed he was hiding from deportation and couldn't risk contacting them. So Kanagaratnam was last seen around December of 2015 at the age of 37. Police believe he was killed roughly 2 years after being denied refugee status, and he was never reported missing.
Yeah.
So this is another person who just wasn't on the radar.
Yeah.
That same spring, Justin Ling got another phone call from a man who claimed to have a sexual encounter with Bruce that turned violent. So we just get a little more insight into the way that Bruce MacArthur worked.
Yeah.
So this man was named Peter Sagromo. And he said he met Bruce in the early 2000s through a support group for gay dads. So Peter wasn't a dad, but he did come out later in life, like most of the men in the group. So he didn't go to the meetings, but usually hung out with them for brunch afterwards. So Peter left Canada to work in the U.S. and then came back to Canada in 2017. And that's when he reconnected with Bruce over the dating app Bear 411. So Bruce was really aggressive over the app about meeting up. They had never been particularly good friends. So Peter was sort of weirded out by how much he really wanted to see him. And he decided to bring a friend just in case. You know, he wasn't planning on hooking up with Bruce. And he just wanted to make sure that this wasn't some sort of weird thing.
Which it absolutely ended up being. So, he was 100% right.
Right. His gut was right. Right. So the three men, they actually had a great time hanging out and catching up. They were laughing and telling stories. And the only thing that stood out to Peter, he said, is a story Bruce told. He had just returned home from Rome, and he was just, you know, talking about Italian men, all about Italian men. And then he talked about one guy in particular who just was into really rough sex. So he got kind of graphic about how rough this guy liked his sex. And Peter just remembered that anecdote. It stood out for him, striking him as odd, you know, because he was like, I didn't know Bruce was into that. He doesn't kind of give off that vibe. And then it just seemed kind of like out of line with what
a little,
they were doing.
Maybe a little TMI. He's talking about the Vatican 1 second.
You know, I mean, it seemed like it just kind of stuck out like a sore thumb, right? So they did have a really fun time, and they all left to go home. And Bruce offers Peter a ride back to his hotel, right? And Peter's like, okay. And then Bruce unexpectedly kissed him. And Peter was into it. They had had this great night. The kiss was great. And, you know, so they're kind of like kissing by the car. And Bruce opens the door to his van. And Peter looks down and he sees all the seats have been taken out, right? So at first he's feeling like, oh, that's super weird. What's this thing? And then he remembers, oh, yeah, Bruce is a landscaper.
That's so what I would have thought.
Right.
Yeah.
He's using his van for hauling. And then from the look of Bruce's face, right, he realizes, oh, this is also doubling as like a fun sex van.
Yeah.
So Peter consensually entered the van and they started messing around. But Bruce started getting violent like right away. So he's twisting Peter's neck around and yanking him around by his hair, like 2 minutes in. And this is not something they had talked about.
Yeah.
This was not something that like Peter at all thought it would be part of the deal.
Yeah.
No warning, no discussion or anything. And Bruce was twisting his Peter's neck so hard that alarm bells start going off for Peter. This wasn't a sex thing. He was being attacked, right? Yeah. So Peter Sagromo is a big tank of a dude with solid self-defense training.
Yeah.
So he basically just jacked up Bruce's elbow in a hold until Bruce let him go.
Oh, like an arm breaker kind of thing?
Yeah, right. So he just kind of held him, and then finally Bruce let go of his hair and let him sit back. Peter said the whole thing was just really weird and honestly kind of hard to process in the moment.
Sure. But
basically what he said was he thought that maybe Bruce's kink was taking things a little too far pain-wise. You know, like he wasn't really sure of this, what this was, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But as it was happening, he could feel the violence escalating.
Yeah.
And also, he noted that Bruce wasn't aroused at all. He didn't have an erection. It didn't seem sexual for Bruce at all. So Peter's impression was the attack wasn't sexual. He was just using sex to restrain and to hurt him, right? So after Peter got his bearings, he was kind of shaken up, and he said he called Bruce out for being so violent. And Bruce kind of just sat there and didn't really say anything or explain himself.
Yeah.
And Peter was like, just take me home, right? So he stayed in the back of the van, and Bruce drove him back to his hotel. He went back to his hotel and went to sleep.
Well, that's how, that was the same way he acted after he tried to strangle the other guy in the van too. When the guy's yelling at him and he doesn't say anything and just gets in the car. I mean, he ends up driving himself to the police station in that one, but that behavior is identical.
Right. It's just like shut down and move away.
Yeah. You know, don't run away. Don't try to justify. Don't try to smooth it over.
Don't try to explain.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But in all of those instances too, you have people moving into a trusted, you know, like into a situation with a trusted person.
Yeah.
You know, with full consent.
Right.
And then that person uses that.
Right.
You know, like Bruce is using that moment of trust to sort of escalate things in a way that it's almost confusing. You know?
Totally. Yeah.
So by April 23rd, police had identified 7 bodies from the planters, but had found no trace of Majid Hamid Kahan, right? Mm-hmm. He's just not around. And that's one of our victims from Project Houston.
Right.
So by July, police made this sort of awful discovery. They realized
worse than what so far?
They realized MacArthur had been packing the remains of his victim into these seasonal planters.
Uh-huh.
And then when it was time to change the plants out or discard the dead flowers from the last season,
mm-hmm.
he was just dumping them into the ravine behind Karen Fraser's house.
Yeah.
So from the 4th through the 12th, police excavated the ravine. And they found human remains on almost all of the 8 days that they searched.
Yeah.
These human remains belonged ultimately to the victims that they had identified.
Yeah.
But it just meant that he had dismembered them into pieces and then was just throwing some of their pieces into the ravine.
Right.
So, you know, Jesus Christ. On July 20th, police announced that Hamid's remains had been found in the ravine.
Mm-hmm.
Police found his remains about 5 feet from where Karen Fraser had last seen him working with Bruce MacArthur years before.
It's so freaky.
At this point, all 8 victims' remains had been identified. And Detective Sergeant Hank Edzinga announced that he didn't believe police would find any more remains on the Fraser property or any of the hundreds of other properties that Bruce worked on in the greater Toronto area. Because this was a huge, you know, excavation mission. They weren't just at Karen Fraser's house. They were at all of these different places checking planters.
Yeah, and everywhere he's been working.
Yeah, but they didn't find anything else.
Uh-huh.
However, police are going to look into missing persons dating back to the 1970s when Bruce MacArthur started working at Eaton's department store near the village. And then later when he worked as a traveling sock and underwear salesman all around the greater Toronto area, completely unsupervised.
Mm-hmm.
So on January 29th, 2019, the day after Skanda's birthday, people affected by Bruce MacArthur's crimes, the family and friends of the victims, were invited to a court session. They drove through a nasty snowstorm to a Toronto courtroom where Bruce MacArthur pled guilty to all 8 counts of murder. There would be no trial.
He just pled guilty, just straight up.
Yeah. In early February, just a few weeks later, the temp unnaturally warmed up to 6 degrees Celsius, which is 42 degrees in freedom units.
Okay. And freedom units? Is that like a weird American way of saying Fahrenheit?
And the courtroom was just like packed for the sentencing deliberation.
Uh-huh.
The Crown attorney read a 36-page account of Bruce MacArthur's acts, and family and friends read their victim impact statements. According to reporting by Kate McGillivray for the CBC News, quote, while Crown attorney Michael Cantlin read the agreed statement of facts to a silent courtroom, a gaunt MacArthur stared straight ahead. For years, members of the LGBTQ community in Toronto believed they were being targeted by a killer, Cantlin began. They were right. So 6 out of the 6 victims had been staged after their deaths, and they were all restrained, sexually assaulted, and strangled.
Mm.
Most still had the murder weapons around their necks.
Oh.
According to the report, some men were shaved after their deaths, mm-hmm. and police eventually found bags of their hair in Bruce MacArthur's apartment.
Oh, so creepy.
And then other people were dressed up in the fur coat. They have, he had a fur hat that he used to use.
Yeah.
All the photos were organized by victim in different folders, but Bruce MacArthur actually didn't know the names of 3 of his victims at all.
Oh, and Bruce is the one doing the organizing of the photos.
Right.
So the photos is like a big prize for him.
Right. That's also something he kept. I mean, everything he kept, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, based on that, they realized he didn't even know the names of 3 of his victims. He didn't know Krishna Kumar Kadagaratnam. Yeah. He didn't know Sarush Mahmoodi's name, and he didn't know Salim Essen's name either.
Mm.
The report also included a timeline of the failures of police to properly track Bruce MacArthur over the years. This was stemming back to his 2013 interview with police and then the 2016 accusation of assault against Bruce MacArthur that police dismissed without checking into his record. Bruce MacArthur ended proceedings by declining to speak, saying, quote, no, Your Honor, I've discussed it with my counsel. I don't want to say anything. On February 8th, 2019, Bruce MacArthur was sentenced to the Canadian maximum, 25 years without the possibility of parole, with sentences served concurrently.
Mm-hmm.
So he'll be 91 at the time of his first parole hearing.
Uh-huh.
After his conviction, Toronto Police Chief Mark Saunders refused to open an internal review regarding police conduct, saying he wasn't going to, quote, dissect the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
However, starting way back in September 2018, former Ontario Court of Appeal Judge Gloria Epstein began conducting an independent review of how the Toronto police force dealt with missing persons in the village.
Yeah.
So there was a major review coming out.
Mm-hmm.
According to Chris Fox for CTV News, the 1,100-page review, which was released in its entirety in 2021, concluded that, quote, police could have done better. So Epstein wrote that Bruce MacArthur's victims were, quote, marginalized and vulnerable in a variety of ways, and that their disappearances were often given less attention or priority than they deserved by police.
Mm-hmm.
Epstein also said that some of the officers investigating the cases had, quote, misconceptions or stereotypical ideas about LGBTQ2S plus communities, and that those perceptions impeded their work. So let's talk first about the 2013 interview. We've talked about this a bunch.
Yeah.
So if you remember from part one of the story, right, before Bruce MacArthur killed his last 5 victims, he was brought in for questioning in 2013 regarding the disappearances of the men from Project Houston.
Yeah.
So Epstein called that 16-minute interview, quote, deeply flawed. A fairly junior detective constable named Joshua McKenzie was tasked with interviewing Bruce MacArthur in 2013. He didn't do a background check or run Bruce MacArthur's name through the national database where he would have found Bruce MacArthur's prior conviction mm-hmm. for the unprovoked pipe attack.
Yeah.
McKenzie also didn't prepare any questions for the interview, and he didn't make any note to record that Bruce MacArthur was called in initially for his internet interactions with Skanda and Basir, but ended up openly also admitting he had a relationship with the 3rd victim in Project Houston, Hamid.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So Bruce MacArthur did deny knowing Basir, but Detective McKenzie just didn't question him any further. So they had proof that he had an interaction with Basir. And then he says, oh no, I don't know him.
Yeah.
And he just took him at his word and moved on.
Right.
And after the interview, no supervisor reviewed the information. And no one followed up with Bruce MacArthur at all based on that interview throughout the rest of the time. Then fast forward to 2016. In the summer of 2016, when Bruce MacArthur was accused of an attempted strangulation in the back of his van, Sergeant Paul Gauthier handled the complaint and failed again to do a background check on Bruce MacArthur. And he also just didn't realize he had access to databases that held information from the 2013 interview. So that was recorded. The information was there, but he didn't realize like that's a database he could have even run Bruce MacArthur's name through. So that's what she's realizing is like when we're talking about miscommunication. Like it's not necessarily intentional, but like there was just these people who were in the organization that didn't know
what they had access to.
What they had access to, which is really kind of crazy when you think about it.
Yeah.
So Gauthier didn't take a proper statement from the victim. He didn't photograph the victim's injuries as he's required to do. He didn't follow up on the victim's claim that he had dash cam footage from the related to the attack. So he says, I have footage, right? And nobody had even looked at it. That's how little they followed up on this situation.
That's pretty unbelievable.
Right. And in the end, Sergeant Paul Gauthier opted to release Bruce MacArthur without charging him. And that after that, he went on to kill at least two people.
Yeah.
In 2019, Gauthier was charged with insubordination and neglect of duty for his handling of that arrest in 2016.
Yeah.
But he was found not guilty in 2021. So there's a lot of controversy surrounding it.
Sure.
And the idea of like what was intentional and what was like a system-wide issue.
Totally. Right? God, this is so recent.
I know.
Gives me shivers.
Yeah. To sum up some of this stuff, Epstein wrote, quote, I cannot say that MacArthur would necessarily have been apprehended earlier if these investigative steps had been taken. He was a true psychopath. He disarmed others, including Detective Constable McKenzie, with his calm and ostensibly helpful approach to the interview.
Yeah.
But the Toronto police did lose important opportunities to identify him as the killer.
Yeah.
The central conclusion of the report was basically that the Toronto Police Department had a really crappy data managing practices and poor communication within the department itself, particularly when it came to missing people, and poor communication with the public. With Epstein writing that poor communication resulted in, quote, heightened existing mistrust in the community and, quote, ultimately diminished rather than protected the integrity of the existing and future investigations. She also added that this lack of communication reinforced the broadly held impression that police did nothing.
Mm-hmm.
To their credit, by the time Gloria Epstein's report came out in 2021, Police Chief Mark Sanders was out. He was ousted.
For this reason?
It's all a lot.
I don't know. There were other issues at hand too.
Confidence and something else in an election. I don't remember.
Wow. Okay.
But so he was out. Okay. And the interim police chief, James Raymer, publicly apologized to the village community and promised to implement all of Epstein's 151 recommendations in regards to improving missing persons investigations. So they had definitely done like a 180 in terms of how they were speaking to the public.
Well, that sounds like a good thing.
Yeah, it's a good thing.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking for some good stuff from this story, Muriel. This is freaking drastic. I have so many questions.
Okay, right. Well, we're going to keep going a little bit longer.
Okay.
So like I said before, you know, the year prior, back in 2018 in February, police had already started to expand the investigations to include more cold cases in the greater Toronto area, nationally and abroad.
Right, and also like back in the day when he was working these other jobs and everything.
Right.
Okay, this is one of my questions.
And nothing I could find said anything about this panning out,
uh-huh.
but there's a lot of speculation.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to take a minute to just do a quick sort of pop science profiling of Bruce MacArthur as a serial killer, because I think it kind of helps understand what he's done before and put it in context, and it helps with maybe what he's capable of doing that we don't know about.
Okay.
Right? But also,
yeah,
the author of our book, Justin Ling, the one that we read for this episode.
I didn't read it. Don't bring we into this. You read this. This is your doing.
You know, he really is like very much vocally like against all of this pop analysis of serial killers.
Okay.
A lot of that's because like the data set's so small. So he's like, people act like these trends are hard and fast, but yeah, it's not a huge data set that they have.
Okay.
So, you know, he thinks a lot of what he saw as a journalist during this time had to do with like, oh, he would have done this and he would have done that. Bruce, like a lot of speculation that he thought was really annoying.
Yeah,
so I'm going to be one of those people.
You're not holding yourself to any kind of journalistic integrity.
Don't say that. But I mean, I'm obviously not a journalist.
Right.
But I'm actually doing this because I want to tell you, because I think you're going to think a lot of your questions that I'm anticipating you're going to ask are going to be sort of answered by this last section of our story.
Okay, well, we'll see how predictable I am.
Because I think you might be. Okay.
That's fucked up.
So Michael Arntfeld is a criminology professor at the University of Western Ontario. And he told the Toronto Star that Bruce MacArthur's crimes, quote, bust decades-long trends, right?
Mm-hmm.
Bruce MacArthur was basically just hella old to start serial killing in his 50s. That's just not very common.
Yeah.
Partly because of diminishing testosterone. Because of that, that's when most male serial killers start to slow down, not escalate.
Mm-hmm.
So according to Michael Arntfeld, he believes Bruce MacArthur could have started much earlier, and that this, quote, could be the longest run of a serial killer on record, not only in Canada, but anywhere. I'd suggest police need to look back at least 35 years. So that's what he believes.
Okay. Yeah.
Also, according to Arntfeld, only about 4% of serial killers actually practice dismemberment at all. And it's almost always practical, like used as a way to hide or dispose of the body.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a quote from him. He says, when you see excessive effort put into something, creating a visual or doing something that has no value added to the crime and in fact poses additional risk forensically, you know it is strictly in service to a fantasy that means nothing to anyone but the killer. It's also rare for a serial killer to mutilate and dismember as part of their ritual, like part of this fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very rare for a killer to conceal body parts after dismemberment, especially in a city. So I guess like he's just saying like, you know, if you live in a big city, they're not like dismembering body parts, then moving them to a different part in the city that you also work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that didn't have anything really to do with concealment. It just had to do with keeping everything close by in a way.
Okay. So he's just saying this guy was weird. What's the point of bringing that up? Just to illustrate how truly one of a kind Bruce MacArthur was.
He just talks about how, essentially that he breaks so many trends that there's probably a lot we don't know about what he did. There might be a lot more we don't know.
Okay.
You know, and he finishes by saying, putting them in such a conspicuous location where only he knew and then gifting them to unwitting participants in this macabre game he's playing is very much about power. It's about toying with people. So that's his kind of impression.
Take on it, yeah.
Now, based on what Wikipedia and FBI.com have to say, this is how you could potentially characterize Bruce MacArthur as a serial killer. So the FBI puts serial killers into three categories. You have organized serial killers. Those are people who carefully plan crimes and often target marginalized people to avoid being caught.
Mm-hmm.
You have disorganized killers, people who kill with whatever's available to them and then leave the bodies out in the open.
Like where the murder actually happened.
Exactly.
Right.
And then finally, you have mixed serial killers. So generally, killers who start out organized and become disorganized, or the other way around. Start out disorganized and become organized.
Right. I remember all this.
Right.
Yeah.
So it seems like Bruce is pretty organized, but if he started earlier, he could have developed his technique over time. So instead of the pipe incident being the first time, you know, if we could think of it as being something that was started much earlier.
Which, to be honest, you know, there's a lot of things I started early in my life where I'm like planning to really hit my stride in my 50s. So... you know, in that way, he serves as a role model. I don't know.
Terrible thing.
Yeah.
So there are generally four motives for serial killing. So these are broken down into visionary. So that's people who have like psychotic breaks that talks with the devil or God or whatever. Right. Uh-huh. And then you have mission oriented. serial killings, which are ridding the world of a particular type of person.
Right. I feel like you hear that a lot with like serial killers who murder young women or something.
Right.
And it's
right.
like they're like whores or whatever word they use.
Horrible. Yeah.
The
third is hedonistic. So that's killers who get some sort of pleasure and see people as a means to an end. Right. And so they get like, they satisfy a sexual impulse, or they're trying to satisfy like getting material possession. So that would be like a pirate that kills a lot of people, right? Somebody who then gets their riches, right? Like, okay. or black widows, you know, people who go and marry and then murder and get inheritances.
Okay.
And then also for thrill, that's like just satisfies a thrill. Mm-hmm. And then finally, the last motive is power or control. So the motivation for this is domination. So sex can be an access, like an aspect of power and control, but it's not because of lust. It's using sex as a tool for domination.
Yeah, which sounds like our guy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then for serial offenders, just of crime, like serial offenders, it could be any type of crime. Mm-hmm. There are typically four ways that serial offenders move geographically. So it's either poaching someone outside of their former home area, hunting. So you're hunting down a particular victim without leaving your home area. Trolling, which would be someone who's always at the ready to commit a crime of opportunity at home or abroad. And finally, the trapper, someone who makes their victims feel safe, drawing them into seemingly harmless situations. Mm-hmm. So based on these archetypes, I could see Bruce MacArthur as an organized or mixed killer who's motivated by power and control, who behaved like a trapper, right? Basically because of how he presented himself as this harmless Santa Claus, grandpa type, and probably gravitating towards the BDSM communities helped him find victims who were comfortable with restraints and would give their consent without like struggling, right?
Yeah.
Thinking that they're agreeing to one thing when really it turns out to be another.
Ugh.
And remember, this type of offender doesn't necessarily have to have a geographic base, but is looking for the most successful result with the least amount of effort. So that would be like a quick pop science version of Bruce MacArthur's modus operandi.
Sure,
right?
sure. That makes sense. I mean, I get why Justin Ling is like, that's BS, but that also...
Like, it kind of
that's
fits.
Not, doesn't, that's not like some crazy stretch.
Right. I mean, I think like if you read it, and then like that's kind of generally how these cases are profiled, and then that person kind of clicks into one of those things really easily.
Yeah.
It's just interesting.
Yeah.
So around April 2018... You know, police announced they're going to look into 15 unsolved murders that occurred in the village between 1975 and 1997 who fit the general profile of MacArthur's victims.
Yeah.
And given that some people believe Bruce MacArthur could have started his crimes much earlier, there was a lot of attention in the public and the press given to another cluster of murders in the Toronto village in the 1970s. So this is a very, like, infamous cluster of murders.
Uh-huh.
According to reporting from Vijosai Sai for the Toronto Star, between 1975 and 1978, police were confronted with 14 murders of gay men that followed a similar pattern of overkill, in which the victims were, in some cases, tied up, beaten, and stabbed excessively.
Yeah.
Half of these cases have gone cold. MacArthur would have been between 23 and 26 years old at the time of those deaths.
Mm-hmm.
So he would also have been living and working in Toronto at Eaton's department store just a few blocks away from the village when these deaths occurred.
Mm-hmm.
The first murder happened on February 18th, 1975. A 52-year-old man named Arthur Walkley was stabbed to death in his home after last being seen in the village. And then later that year, a man named Fred Fontaine was fatally beaten in the bathroom of the St. Charles Tavern in the village. Then two more men were found naked and strangled in like 1976 and 1977 after leaving St. Charles. So a lot of these deaths were basically connected to that particular tavern.
Yeah. But
this is back in the 70s where we talked about there were only two sort of, you know, clear gay bars on the strip. There was St. Charles and then I think there were more popping up, but St. Charles was like the big one.
Yeah, right.
And according to Lisa Mayer, Jen White, and Salmon Malik's article, quote, "It happened before" for the CBC News, these killings obviously terrorized the already vulnerable neighborhood. You know, same-sex relationships had just been decriminalized in 1969.
Yeah.
So like the bars in the village, in the early village, were a safe haven from just straight up physical harm towards the LGBTQ community.
Well, you were telling stories about how, you know, for their like Halloween parade and everything, people would just show up and attack them.
Right. And like throw stuff. Yeah. And it wasn't just citizens. It was also police. There were lots of violent arrests and different things happening between the, you know, the village community and the police.
Right.
So the space where Zippers, the village gay bar, Bruce MacArthur, Skanda, and many other people involved in this case called Home Base, in part one of this episode, it operated for 16 years. But way back in 1978, it was a bar called Studio 2. So Studio 2 was massive. It had a movie theater / drag queen stage downstairs. Like, here's a quote from the book Missing in the Village. Quote, "It was a complex of a bar. There was a movie theater downstairs, doubling with needed as a drag queen theater. It even had a concession stand. There was a myriad of bars, a dance floor, a cafe, a board games room, a jungle themed room.
Oh, hell
and
yeah.
Even a makeup store for queens in search of a friendly place to shop."
Oh my God. That place sounds amazing.
It's just like a huge place.
That's sick.
So one of the pioneers of gay ownership of gay bars in the area was this badass dude named Sandy LeBlanc. So Sandy LeBlanc was 5'3". He dressed like head to toe, just like a tough ass biker.
Yeah.
He drove a motorcycle, and then he was like really known to beat up rowdy customers in his bar. So he would just be like ass kicking.
Yeah. Yeah.
On September 20th, 1978, after celebrating the second anniversary of Studio 2, Sandy disappeared.
Oh, no.
And no one could get a hold of him. So the next day, some friends busted down his apartment door, and they found him naked and face down in his bed, stabbed over 100 times.
Oh, fucking God.
And Sandy was actually the fourth LGBTQ plus person murdered in the community that past month. So they started in 1975, and then they started escalating through the Jesus. Late 1970s, right?
Yeah.
So here's another quote from the It Happened Before article.
Yeah.
Quote, "News reports in 1978 noted 14 of what were called homosexual killings in the 3.5 years. The cases presented some similarities. Many of the men were last seen leaving the St. Charles Tavern. Most were found in their homes, stabbed or killed by blunt force trauma in a manner police call overkill. And they were all members of the gay community. Most of the victims were also found naked." And then here's an excerpt from the same article that describes history repeating itself.
Mm-hmm.
So after the 14 unsolved village murders in the 70s, quote, "tension between police and the gay community in Toronto escalated, and it came to a head during the bathhouse raids in 1981, where more than 250 gay men were arrested in 4 bathhouses in one night. Police busted down the doors. They tore apart the bathhouses. They tore apart the lockers. And, you know, it was a super aggressive arrest. And, you know, you remember in part one of this episode in 2016, when police raided Marie Curtis Park and arrested 89 men for cruising for sex while there was an active serial killer targeting the community.
Right.
The exact same thing happened in 1981. There were all these unsolved murders that were targeting the village community. And like right when those investigations should have been happening, that's attention's turned toward doing these mass raids for people in bathhouses.
It's crazy.
Yeah. So that's like insane. A big part of like in 2016, you know, when you start to look at the history of like what happened, people were like a lot of people who were there in 2016 were also some of them were there in 1978.
I mean, I say that's crazy and insane. I mean, I'm aware that like gay pride was like born out of Stonewall and, you know, and all this kind of stuff. So it's not like complete news to me, but it is shocking nonetheless to hear just this one community's, you know, repeated experience.
Right. And and why the talk of there being a serial killer, you know, had these really deep roots in the community. Like again, you know, when it started in 2010, people, you know, were like, that was just 30 years ago. This exact same thing started happening and nothing came out of it. You know, there was no serial killer found at the moment.
But there is plenty of time for Bruce MacArthur to confess to more stuff if he has that. I mean, he's alive and healthy and in jail as we're recording this.
So this is our last little bit.
Okay. Right.
So given Bruce MacArthur's history and his profile, you know, it's not a crazy stretch to say Bruce MacArthur may have transitioned from a disorganized killer to an organized killer by 2010. That his 2000 pipe attack on Mark Henderson wasn't his first offense. No one knows for sure. But from my research, a lot of people wonder if he committed crimes in the village in the 1970s while working as a traveling salesman in the greater Toronto area in the 1980s or committed crimes abroad. Mm-hmm. You know, if he fits the trapper model of serial offenders, he wouldn't need a particular geographical location to commit his crimes, just somewhere where he could blend in and make people feel he wasn't a threat.
Right.
Probably somewhere where marginalized people hung out or missing persons investigations weren't a priority for law enforcement.
Yeah.
So, after working on this episode, I kept going back to our time in Puerto Vallarta.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Like we mentioned the first part of this episode, you can walk into Nacho Daddy on a Thursday night in Zona Romantica and find 10 dead ringers for Bruce MacArthur, having the time of their lives, completely at home, friendly, easy to talk to. You know, people would just be like, oh, that guy's great, right?
Yeah, right.
So, I did a little bit of research into this, and while Puerto Vallarta is statistically super safe with a low crime rate, their missing persons ratio is actually pretty high.
Ooh.
So according to the Mexico Daily Post, in 2021, there were 469 adults missing in Puerto Vallarta out of a population of about 220,000. So ironically, it was actually really hard for me to find specific missing persons data for Los Angeles, but I did some rough math to find a comparison. So,
ooh, rough math.
So California has the highest rate of missing people. The state of California has the highest rate of missing people in the U.S., with Los Angeles County leading the pack in terms of most missing persons in like a municipality, right?
Whoa, I didn't know that.
So around 10,000 people, according to the state of California's Department of Justice went missing in 2021. But our population is about 10 million, right?
Right.
So that means we have about 100 people missing per 100,000 people, where Puerto Vallarta has about twice that number at 213 people missing at 100,000 people, right?
Yeah.
So we're like the highest
if
of the high.
If we're trusting Muriel
state,
with her rough
with
math. Yeah.
And granted, I may not know where to look,
yeah,
but for the record, I couldn't find any concrete missing person statistics for 2021 in Toronto. So I'm like, are these? That seems odd. I couldn't.
Right.
It was like a message from the police saying like, this is internal data. And I was like, maybe I searched for the wrong thing, but I was like, I hope they're still doing those like implementations of like things they said they were going to change.
Yeah, totally.
But I guess my highly anecdotal point is, while Bruce MacArthur was at the height of his 2016-2017 killing spree, he took a vacation where everyone is super relaxed and having fun, and also a lot of people disappear.
Thanks for that, Muriel.
That's for you, my love.
Okay, great. So I have, I guess, two remaining questions, but it's really one question.
Okay, right.
Why did you do this? No. What is up with his roommate and his son who was living with him at the time? I mean, one, it sounds like one attempted murder happened in their house and they never offered any statements or had any public or whatever official
as far
statements like illuminated anything
as listen.
Yeah.
I watched a documentary and then I read a book and then I also read like, I don't know, 40 articles or something about this case. Like,
yeah. I think it's safe to say you did a little too much.
I know. Because it's like it's a huge, it's just like a huge complicated case.
Right.
But
no, I get it. Yeah.
Out of all of that,
yeah,
the only quote that I found from any family member at all was Todd MacArthur being mad that people were like, he got in trouble again for making obscene phone calls like around the time his dad had been arrested. And so he was mad. He's like, we've been through enough already. Leave us alone. But nobody, the daughter who had the van in her, you know, her
yard,
driveway, like the roommate, his wife, his ex-wife, you know, his, like, none of the people that I saw brought any sort of substantial like statement.
And they're in the documentaries?
No, they're not in anything.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I'm saying. It's like the family and the people around him definitely didn't come out. The only person who around him who actually came out who was friends with Bruce MacArthur's sister was Karen Frazier. Karen Frazier is, you know, she did tons of interviews for the documentary. She was heavily featured. She did tons of interviews for Justin Ling. She basically is a really interesting character in this because she's, you know, like we can paint her as being this kind of like philanthropic, you know, rich lady who's kind of like living in this house and whatever. Yeah. But she's like won awards for her community service work in like the greater Toronto area.
Yeah.
She does stuff like raise money for prom dresses for children in need.
And yeah.
She does tons of stuff. And, you know, she's really, you know, public about being like, this is my home. I'm not going to leave because I didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah.
And she's like, I'm going to stay here. But she told Justin Ling, like, I want to open my home up. If it gives some of the families closure to come and see my gardens and be in the house, like they're welcome to come and like be here, you know, anything I can do to help repair some of the pain that's happened here.
Yeah.
You know, she's a really, really great speaker. She's very, a really interesting person. She's the only one connected to the case who said anything.
Well, I mean, it just is so much, you know, your dad, your ex-husband, your loved one, turns out to be this person who's just got to rock your whole foundation of self.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was your one question?
But the main thing was like, what was going on in this apartment?
I know.
There's like,
I mean,
three people living in there and then obviously some people are coming and going and there's like a bag full of hair in the apartment and assuming like he probably killed other people there. And it just seems like if you're killing people in your work van and you're killing people in your house, people who work with you and live with you might
catch on.
Yeah. Or see it at all. I don't know.
I mean, I think that's like, you heard that a little bit of shade in that statement by Mark Saunders. Like, you know, there's definitely like the implication that people close to him were not helping.
Yeah.
But there's no, as far as anybody knows, nobody faced any charges. The only other person who faced charges in relation to this was the detective that mishandled the 2016 arrest. That was it.
Man. All right. Well, besides giving all praises due to Justin Ling, you got anyone else you want to shout out for their resources?
Yes. I watched Catching a Serial Killer, Bruce MacArthur, directed by James Buddy Day. So this is a documentary that just goes over a lot of the specifics of, you know, the way that the case was built against Bruce MacArthur and then the arrest. So those moments of having to go up the elevator.
Totally.
Get to the top of the thing.
Which is just like out of a really tragic Pink Panther movie or something.
It's just like, oh my God. You know, they didn't have, just not having the people in place to do it and being like, we have to take that elevator. It's just wild. And then the other person I pulled from was Nicole Brockbank for CBC News. So she just has done a ton of reporting on this and she did a lot of like great timeline stuff.
Yeah.
So you could just go through and be like, when did that happen?
totally.
Which, you know, you had that moment earlier when I was really shitting about
I had a lot of moments earlier, man. This is crazy. Well, I guess it's because MacArthur never confessed. I was really dreading hearing about the specifics of how he killed people and how he cut them up and stuff, or I didn't even know he cut people up at the time. And I, you know, was spared that because he never confessed, I suppose. And it sounds like he was not a cannibal also, just because there was like a lot of cannibalism.
Yeah. And I think he was not a
other
cannibal.
Crimes happening and that were connected at the time. But it sounds like he was not eating people.
Yeah. He was just doing his Bruce MacArthur thing.
Oh,
terrible thing. It's interesting. I think you learn more about what he did just by listening to the people who survived describe what their experiences were.
Yeah.
You know, again and again, it just seems like that trapper thing just kept coming back in my head. I had read it in some article somewhere that he being described as a trapper. And I was like, that's exactly what it is. It's just somebody who draws people in, who feels safe. And that's how they get their victims.
Yeah.
And that was how it was, like just people coming forward and saying, it was really nice. We had a great time. We had a great night. I've known him for years.
Yeah.
This is like the fourth date that we'd had.
Right.
We have like BDSM sessions that we've done before.
Right.
And like have ground rules for, and yeah. we know what we like and what we don't like. You know, it's like people who he had a lot of
intimacy with
yeah. and a lot of sort of space available to just make people feel comfortable.
Man, gotta send out an RIP to all the victims, and man, just so much love to all their families, because everyone's still got family around. This is so recent. It's crazy.
Yeah, it is. It's the most recent thing I think we've ever done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm sweating.
Okay. Well, maybe that's time to stop.
Are we done?
Yeah.
Thank you so much for listening to Muriel's Murders. Muriel did all the research and I did all the engineering, editing, and post-production. This podcast was recorded in our living room.
To help support the podcast and to unlock exclusive episodes, please sign up for our Patreon at www.patreon.com/Muriel's Murders.
For photos of us hanging out at the Botanical Gardens and bars Bruce MacArthur used to hang out, find us on Instagram at Muriel's Murders. Our DMs are open. And, you know, maybe you think NFTs are stupid. Maybe you think they're amazing. Maybe you think they're only just, you know, apes and pixelated punk rockers. Either way, NFTs are a great way to support Muriel's Murders by checking out voice.com/saltygray and buy an NFT of art by yours truly. This zero carbon platform accepts either crypto or regular credit card payments, and they start at just $5. The link is in the show notes of this episode. And it's just, you know, maybe you just would consider that a really fun way to give us some dollars and get something incredibly awesome, as a Nick NFT.
It's so funny how we're so separate when we do these, because I don't tell you what I'm doing before yeah. I do it.
Yeah.
And then you don't tell me you're making NFT.
You know,
until I hear the plug on, I'm always just like, what? You're doing NFTs. All right.
Shout out to my bros out there doing NFTs get behind their wives' backs.
Please rate and review Muriel's Murders on Apple Podcasts. It actually really does help us grow. If you're enjoying, throw us some stars.
Yeah.
And if you're listening on Spotify, guess what? You can rate and review us as well. They started doing that. So
yeah, you can't review us, but you can give us 5 stars, which would be great. Awesome.
Whatever. Yeah. And so the other thing you can do is add this episode to a playlist of podcasts your friends might like. You know, if you're feeling generous.
Yeah.
That's great.
Good job, Muriel. Okay. Our music is by Mario Castellini. Our music is by Mario Castellini. Find him on Instagram at Castellini Beats.
Thank you to Ryan and Ryan at Campfire Media.
And if you want more Nick and Muriel, please check out our non-murder podcast, Hella in Your 30s, wherever you get your podcasts.
That's it.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Michael McMillan. I'm 6'1", and I'm based in Los Angeles. Ever wonder what life is like for the working Hollywood actor? Every week on Slate Your Name, I sit down with actors, creators, and performers to find out how they're coping with the highs and lows of the entertainment industry. Hear Crazy Ex-Girlfriend's Rachel Bloom talk about struggling with auditioning.
I think they just weren't good auditions. The feedback from both was like, I was very green and not good.
How Tom Everett Scott booked That Thing You Do with Tom Hanks.
Here I am going to meet the guy who I basically am like modeling my whole career after. And I'm just like riddled with nerves. It's one of those moments where you're just like, oh, I'm gonna sabotage myself.
How Rutherford Falls' Janice Schmieding broke into the comedy world.
One way I was able to sort of do that is by sort of giving comedy this space in my life that was just a hobby.
And more. Join me every Tuesday for Slate Your Name from Campfire Media and available wherever you get your podcasts.
Campfire.